From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. Our first guest is Christy Levitt. She is the plastics campaign manager with the nonprofit Oceana, and she's here to talk about something called the Reducing Waste in National Parks Act. This is a new bill sponsored by Senator Jeff Merkley and Representative Mike Quigley. And Christy, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, we'll get to the bill in a minute, but first tell us a little bit about your role as plastics campaign manager with Oceana. What does that involve?
So it means I run Oceana's U.S. plastics campaign, and Oceana is an international organization. We're in North America, South America, Europe, and the Philippines, and in each of our countries, we're working on campaigns to reduce single-use plastics, and specifically, we're focused on reducing the production and use of unnecessary single-use plastic. And to do that, we're looking at national-level policies that make change, as well as state and local policies. So particularly in coastal states where we have staff, we're doing a lot of work with local governments and on the state level. And then across the country, we're working to get Congress and the Biden administration to take action on single-use plastics.
All right, because like we say in the introduction, an estimated 33 billion pounds of plastic is estimated to enter the marine environment every year. That is an astounding number. Do we have a sense of where the majority of that plastic is coming from, let's say, countrywide?
Well, it's coming from all over, and it is the majority of that plastic is coming from land-based sources. Some of it comes from ocean-based sources, but the vast majority is from land-based sources, so around the U.S. and other countries. And the U.S. Is one of the biggest plastic waste producers in the world, so it's not something that we can just say, point at other countries and say, this is your problem, you should figure out how to do it, how to solve it. We are creating a lot of that plastic pollution here in the U.S., and it's our responsibility to take action, and in fact, we're seeing more action in other countries. More than 90 other countries around the world have passed policies that limit single-use plastic on the national level, but so far in the U.S., there hasn't been any national level policies.
All right, maybe until today, until now.
Exactly.
Right, so let's talk about this proposed bill titled the Reducing Waste in National Parks Act. Give us a little summary about what that would cover.
Well, so the bill, as you mentioned, was introduced earlier this month by Representative Quigley from Illinois and Senator Merkley from Oregon. And this actually follows on a bill, versions of this bill that Representative Quigley has introduced in earlier sessions of Congress. And it's called the Reducing Waste in National Park Act. And what it will do will limit plastic waste and pollution throughout the national park system. It expands from what he focused on previously, which only covered plastic water bottles, to now include other single-use plastics, so other types of beverage bottles, plastic bags, plastic foodware, polystyrene foam. And the bill directs the National Park Service to draft plans for reducing the sale and distribution of plastic products at all national parks, and to basically establish national-level guidelines for a program, and then each National Park Service regional director would implement a plan for the parks in their region following that national blueprint. So we're quite excited that the bill has been introduced in both the House and Senate, and that it's expanded on previous versions, because we know it's not just about plastic water bottles. There's other unnecessary single-use plastics that are being distributed and sold at national parks. And so far, 35 other members of the House of Representatives and two other senators have signed on as co-sponsors or supporters of the bill.
And can you take us through kind of a timeline of the voting on this and how this is going to roll out and what that looks like?
Sure. So actually, I'm going to take you back in time first, and then we can go forward. So The reason that this bill was introduced in the first place was because in 2011, during the Obama administration, the National Park Service put in place a policy that allowed individual parks to ban the sale of single-use water bottles. And 23 national parks, including Grand Canyon National Park in Arizona, and then in Utah, Zion, Arches, Bryce Canyon, they all implemented restrictions on bottled water sales, and they made successful reductions in plastic waste. So, for example, at Zion National Park, the park eliminated the sale of 60,000 water bottles, which was basically 5,000 pounds of plastic waste. And they did that by installing bottle filling stations and selling affordable reusable water bottles at their concession stands. And together, these 23 parks with these approved programs reduced between 1.3 million and 2 million disposable plastic water bottles from being purchased and used and discarded. So that's just 23 parks and just about plastic water bottles. Unfortunately, in 2017, the Trump administration got rid of this policy. So national parks didn't have the authority anymore to get rid of single-use plastic water bottles. So here we are, 4 years later. We know the problem isn't just single-use water bottles, and that's why this bill is more expansive. And in addition to the bill being introduced also earlier this year, Oceana, along with 300 or other organizations and businesses, sent a letter to U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland calling on her to direct the National Park Service to eliminate unnecessary single-use plastics in all 423 national parks. Senator Merkley also led a Senate letter in September urging Secretary Haaland to curb single-use plastics in national parks. And now we've got this legislation. So that's a little bit of what's happened before now, including almost a decade ago, and some of the things that have happened this summer. So we're starting to see a lot more momentum from members of Congress, from organizations, and even from just members of the public of wanting to make sure that plastics are limited in national parks. For the bill heading forward, it is already gaining support, as I mentioned. So more than 30 other members of the House, a couple of other senators have signed on as co-sponsors of the bill. It now heads to different committees in both the House and the Senate, and the next step would be for the bills to get a hearing as well. And as these bills move forward through the House and the Senate, we'll continue to be calling on the Park Service directly to institute these policies that limit single-use plastics in national parks.
Yeah, how will you monitor that? What would that look like?
So in terms of reducing the plastic in National Park, what we ultimately want the Park Service to do is to put in place a policy that covers all 400-plus national parks around the country. So it's not just about 23 parks and not just about plastic water bottles. And the National Park Service is part of the Department of the Interior. So as Secretary Haaland could direct the National Park Service to make these changes. Actually, as we speak right now, the nominee for the National Park Service director, Chuck Sams, is in a hearing right now in the Senate. So we're hopeful that he quickly gets confirmed and that he'll be in place before too long to work on important issues like plastics in national parks. So it'll be sort of a twofold strategy here where both the bill will be moving through Congress and then also we're calling on the National Park Service to even act without Congress making them do so. So it's all good momentum towards action to reduce single-use plastics in our national parks.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Christy Leavitt. She's the Plastics Campaign Manager with the nonprofit Oceana. And we're talking about a bill introduced last week in Congress titled the Reducing Waste in National Parks Act. So, Christy, you're saying, you know, right now there was efforts to eliminate plastic bottle, water bottles. And you're saying this is being expanded now to any item that comes in single-use plastic. So if I go to a national park, I'm trying to visualize where I would go, where I would see other plastics being displayed or sold. So it could be at a visitor center. It could be at at a gift shop. It could be, let's say, for those parks that are along the water, at a marina or something, you know, like that. So you're saying that there would no longer be, I don't know, juice sold in plastic bottles, or I couldn't buy juice or soda in plastic. Would it maybe just be cans or snacks sold in plastic? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that is the basic idea, to reduce the unnecessary single-use plastics in national parks. So things like plastic beverage bottles, water bottles, soda bottles, juice bottles, the plastic bag that you might get at the gift shop, or if you're getting food from a concession stand, plastic foam foodware, so the expanded polystyrene foam that sometimes called styrofoam, or other plastic, disposable plastic foodware, so plastic cups, plastic plates, plastic bowls, plastic utensils, those sorts of items are specifically what we're focused on. So it's some of the things that would be provided for to you from a gift shop, or from a convenience store, or from one of the food service sites at a national park. And really what we're doing is we want to get rid of those unnecessary single-use plastics, and at the same time make sure that there's good refillable and reusable options. That's ultimately where not only the National Park Service needs to go, but also the country as a whole needs to move towards more reusables and refillables away from single-use products. And so we're already starting to see that in some of the parks that got rid of single-use plastic water bottles, is that they had more water refill stations and they had inexpensive refillable bottles that were for sale in their concession shops. In the food service areas, you could do reusable cups and bowls and plates and utensils rather than those single-use items. Okay. So those are the sort of changes that we're looking for, particularly in some of the types of products that are easy to either get rid of or to find sustainable alternatives to.
Who in Congress might oppose this? Who's the loyal opposition here?
Well, on the, it's bigger than national parks. I don't know if there's been any stated opposition towards this particular bill and making this change in national parks. But overall, on the plastic industry, is opposed to limiting single-use plastics and other limits on plastics. And when I say the plastic industry, really 99% of plastics is made from fossil fuels. So it's some of the same companies that are fighting change on other issues, like on climate change. And it's the oil and gas companies, it's the petrochemical companies, it's the plastic industry are fighting against change on plastics.
Right, because they might say, look, they're plastics, we use them, and then we recycle them. So let's just, you know, continue our good recycling habits. I could see that argument. In addition to, look, plastics are lightweight and the other usual, you know, positions the plastics lobby might take with respect to the benefits of having single-use plastic. But this is an effort to change behavior entirely, to say, you know what? No more plastics here. We have enough. And actually, that kind of segues to where our last few minutes, we wanted to talk a little more about, you know, Oceana's efforts to address plastic issues in other arenas.
Yeah, not aside just from this. Aside from this initiative, what other current initiatives at this time are you working on that are helping this? Because as Chris stated earlier, that 33 billion pounds of plastic that are entering the marine environment every year, that's a staggering number. And you had placed it or talked about that it's roughly the equivalent of dumping two garbage trucks full of plastic into the ocean every minute. That's just unbelievable to me. So what are some things that you're currently working on that help us to curb that?
Yes, it's a lot of plastic, and it's kind of hard to wrap your head around 33 billion pounds of plastic. That's why we often talk about the two garbage trucks per minute going into the ocean, because that we can actually, you know, think about a little bit more. And we've got a number of initiative that we are working on here in the U.S. and around the world. One thing just to mention on recycling as a solution, that's often both what the plastic industry talks about as well as what people sort of instinctively go to, like, oh, we could just improve our recycling. But the reality is with plastics, we can't recycle our way out of the plastic problems. We really need to reduce the production and use of single-use plastics, because only 9% of all the plastic waste ever generated has been recycled, and current recycling levels in the U.S. are at a similar percentage. Where looking at the most recent years, that's the amount of plastic that we're recycling here in the U.S. The types of things, but let me tell you about the types of things that we are working on.
Sure.
So this year in state legislatures around the country, we've been working to pass policies that reduce single-use plastic. And we've had a number of good successes. In fact, in Washington State and in Virginia, both states passed limits on expanded polystyrene foam, so that plastic foam foodware, and they put in place limits on those. In California, passed legislation that paves the way to move towards reusable and refillable beverage bottles. And both Washington and California passed policies that make it things like plastic utensils and straws and condiment package that sometimes are just thrown in with our takeout food and oftentimes we don't need. They put in place policies where you need to actually ask for those things before you get them. So we're seeing state changes happen at the state level, and then also on the national level. Not only is this particular bill that deals with plastic pollution at national parks, but there's a comprehensive bill called the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act,
right,
that really deals with the whole plastic crisis. I think we got the opportunity to talk about that a few months ago, but we're seeing more momentum build towards that bill too. So lots is happening in states around the country and on the national level, and really states and cities are leading the way on this, and we need the federal government to catch up.
So last minute or two, are you hopeful then that 33 billion pounds per year might drop down to, say, I don't know, 31 or 29 billion pounds a year, at least head in the right direction?
I am hopeful that we will get a handle on the plastic crisis. There's definitely lots of interest from the public around the country and around the world that people are recognizing this is a problem, not only for the oceans, but we're also seeing rain in the Rocky Mountains include bits of plastic too. So we're finding it everywhere. It's in the air, it's in the, you know, our waterways, it's in salt, in other food products. So we're finding it everywhere. People are concerned about that, and that momentum is growing for change on this issue. And as we take on these individual single-use plastics and pass more comprehensive policies, I'm quite hopeful that we'll be able to reduce the amount of plastic going into the ocean.
How would someone get involved with this? Like, what is the best thing that you can tell someone to do, even if it's a small act? What can each of us do to get involved?
And that's a great question. One thing is for people to let their local elected officials, so whether that's your local city councilor, your state senator, you're a member of Congress, let them know that this is an issue that you're concerned about and call on them to take some action, whether that is passing a local level policy to limit the use of single-use plastic bags in your city, whether that's passing a national level policy around reducing plastics in national parks. But people can definitely do things like use a reusable bag, use a reusable water bottle. But the thing that will make the biggest difference is by using our collective voice to create policy level change. That's going to make the even bigger impact there. So encourage people to find out what's happening in their city and their town, and to talk to their local elected officials.
And as far as Oceana is concerned, how do people do maybe a little bit more research on what you're doing? How do they connect with you? Do you have a website
address? The easiest way to find out some more about our plastics campaign, and you can find petitions on our website too, is our website is usa.oceana.org.
And I'll just add that I think the most resonant thing you said, Christy, is the fact that the days of us thinking that we can recycle our way out of the plastic problem are over. We really have to change our behaviors and stop consuming or purchasing plastic, and rethink that and take our own little plastic inventory on what plastics we buy or what things we buy that come in plastic, because we just can't buy things plastic and then think, well, I'm just going to recycle this and the problem will be solved. That's not working anymore. So that's the biggest challenge, I think, on an individual basis, that we ourselves have to stop consuming plastic. So there's my two cents, Christy.
We are definitely past the point where recycling is going to solve this problem, and it's great for people to think about their own plastic use and also think about how we can push these policy level changes too.
Well, Christy Leavitt, Plastics Campaign Manager with the nonprofit Oceana, we thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning to talk about Oceana, the work you're doing, and this Reducing Waste in National Parks Act going through Congress right now. Now we turn our attentions to water. Jordan Clayton, he's the Data Collection Officer with the Utah Snow Survey. He joins us to talk about their monthly reports they put out. And they put one out for the month of September talking about precipitation rates, soil moisture percentages, reservoir levels, et cetera. And we're going to talk about September. We're going to talk about the annual water year, how 2021 did in general compared to other years, and maybe even get to what these last couple of storms have done to our water cycle here in the state.
Yeah.
Jordan, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start there. Let's start with the September water report. How did we do for the month of September, say, compared to others?
Yeah, the month of September was a little bit like most of the rest of 2021. It wasn't outstanding. Certain areas of the state did a little bit better than others, but overall it wasn't as exciting as August. We did receive a little bit of monsoonal moisture in September, but overall August was much more of a banner month, brought in a lot of much needed moisture. September not so much, but it rounded out the year with some interesting facts and figures that we can go over for the whole 2021 water year.
All right, so September, now when we talk about September, okay, that's statewide. Were there any parts of the state that did a little better than others?
Yeah, I actually don't have that distribution in front of me, but it certainly we always see that kind of a pattern where we get some winners and some losers. If I remember correctly, the southern half of the state did a little bit better in the month of September, but I don't have that in front of me.
Okay, so that's September. September ends the water year, I believe. So how did we do in 2021 water year compared to other water years?
Right. So in our report, we talked about bidding adieu to the 2021 water year and good riddance. It was not a very good year. I think, as everybody's aware, we had really exceptional drought conditions for most of the year. And that was statewide. And so just to go through some of our main parameters that we report on, the main thing that our office handles is the water equivalent in the snowpack. And that normally peaks around the beginning of April. And when we were at the beginning of April, we were at about 80% of normal, which isn't terrible. But it only lasted a couple days at that level. And really only 2 weeks later, it was down to about 64-65% of normal, with some areas of the state, like southwestern Utah, all the way down to like 21% of normal. So it really evaporated, if you will, quite quickly, which was only one of our problems. Unfortunately, we also saw extraordinarily low precipitation levels carrying from the previous water year. So that's another thing that helped push us into this drought situation. And those low precipitation levels help drive down the soil moisture levels to the point where we saw record dry soils up in our mountains for most of 2021 water year. They caught up a little bit when the snow melted last spring and early summer, at least to the point where they weren't record minimums anymore, but they were still quite low. And the soil conditions stayed quite dry until we got to that August monsoon. And the August monsoon really helped push those soil moisture levels into average or above average conditions, which is a very welcome change. And we could talk more about what that means for us moving forward. And then the last thing I would mention is the overall flow. Now, obviously, when all that snow melts, we expect there to be some reliable stream flow, and we just didn't get it this year. 17 of our stream flow gauges in the state of Utah out of 94 total, 17 hit record lows for the amount of flow that was received between April 1st and July 31st, and 18 were second lowest. So really, 35 of our sites were either first or second in terms of record minimum flows for that period. So it was just an abysmal year.
Okay, and abysmal year as compared to other years too. I mean, you're saying 35 out of 94, either first or second lowest. Is that like a record low, a record set of numbers there?
It's close. It actually, the USGS provides a whole bunch of useful graphs on their WaterWatch dashboard, and one of them is it shows what's called a cumulative stream flow. So it adds up all the stream flows for the all the gauges in the state, and then it compares that with previous years. And we were hovering a little bit below the previous minimum for a long time. monsoonal precipitation and just conditions that generally favored a little bit more water staying in the streams and some higher flows to help push things just barely above the 1977 levels. So we ended up probably second worst next to 1977 for, again, the cumulative stream flow.
But it seems like, Jordan, that the monsoonal rains we got in July and August, I believe, were really intense type storms that, you know, added, relieved the soil moisture dryness and raised some reservoirs a bit. But we also went long stretches without any precipitation. Is that something that you're seeing happening more often, or if you're kind of modeling this out, is that what we're going to be seeing going into the future with respect to precipitation, whether it's rain or snow?
Yeah, that's a hard question. We don't necessarily know in terms of the frequency of the precipitation if there's sort of confident model results to show that there's going to be a longer frequency between events. We can say with some confidence that we will have more high magnitude events like those intense monsoon storms that we received. And I absolutely agree. There's sort of a limited benefit. We don't, and I really like to reinforce this, we really don't typically see reservoirs filling up from those kinds of monsoonal events. What the monsoon typically does is it decreases the rate of withdrawals, because obviously if you're getting moisture from the sky, you don't need to irrigate as much. You don't need to do, you know, have as many withdrawals. And we also saw really widespread water conservation measures that also slowed the rate of withdrawal from our reservoir system, which we can come back to as well. But my point is that we don't typically see improvement in our reservoir storage from monsoonal precipitation. That comes from snowpack. That comes when the snow melts. And that's why what I try to reinforce is that we're really not going to see an improvement in our current reservoir storage until next spring. So we need to make sure that we're managing appropriately until then.
We're speaking with Jordan Clayton. He's the data collection officer with the Utah Snow Survey. We're talking all things precipitation here in the state, rain and snow. And we'll get to snow in a little bit, because I think we've had some good news or so with respect to October. But we'll hold off on that. we want to finish up this conversation about the annual water year or so.
That's right. So we all know not a great year, almost one of the lowest. And what are some of the actions that were taken this year given that low water table?
Right. So the Division of Water Rights for the state of Utah was busy. It's certainly not my team, so I can't comment exactly on what that looked like, but I can tell you from having heard them give presentations that they were very busy. And so, and you know, this isn't the kind of busy that they want to be. Obviously, everyone does better when we have more water to go around. So what I can say is that we saw a couple months ago the reservoir system statewide. Of course, there's regional differences that are important, but statewide, the reservoir system was at about 49%. And at that time, our office was predicting that by around this time of year that we would be around 35-40% of capacity, that we would be drawn down quite a bit more just based on previous years and trends. And one of the things that we saw that was encouraging was from that month to the beginning of October, it only went down to 48%. So we really slowed the rate of withdrawal significantly, again, especially compared with trends for that time of year. And some of that, again, just has to do with the fact that we received a healthy monsoon, but a lot of that also, I think we really need to give credit to the hard work that has gone on statewide to reduce withdrawals and to make sure that, you know, we were using our prior appropriation system appropriately. And I think that's really where we saw some big conservation benefits.
Yeah, that's a big difference. That's a good changes in behavior there, whether it's on an individual level, municipal levels, water district levels. So the practices seemed to have worked in this case, and now maybe those behaviors get put in place and they become more commonplace.
Yeah, can we be proactive more about this now that I think we're so much more heightened and aware of what's happening as far as water use?
That's what we're all hoping in the water community is that some of the changes that have taken place this year will be long-lasting, persistent, and people maybe will get some behavioral changes in the sense of, you know, for example, the Division of Water Resources has been promoting that yellow is the new green for lawns, and that maybe people will start to migrate more towards low water use landscaping. Certainly, the more we can change individual behaviors, the more we get a statewide benefit. And one of the things that I think has been healthy about this year is that there's been behavioral changes across the board. It's easy to start pointing fingers at either the agricultural sector or the municipal sector or whoever and say, you know, the other side isn't doing enough. But I think this year we saw a really statewide strong efforts to reduce how much we use. And we needed to, because right now we're still at the point where we're almost exclusively in D3 and D4 drought across the state, which is the worst two drought categories. The level of D4 drought has gone way down, and that's great, but we still have most of the state in D3 or D4, which is not where we want to be at all. And so what we're hoping is, and we know we move into the new water year, and it's not like we get a reset. Nature doesn't start over, of course, at the beginning of October, but certainly we're hoping for the best with what we get this fall and then going into the winter. If we could get at least 1 year, if not 2 years, of above average snowpack, that's going to help a lot.
All right, well, let's segue into the new water year. How are we doing so far in the first 20 days of October?
Yeah, it's always a risky time of year to talk about things being any kind of percent of normal, because, you know, this time of year we typically have either minimal or no snow on the ground. So when you compare the numbers that we have on the ground to that, it looks like we have these extraordinarily deep snowpack, but it's just that our background levels are so low. So, for example, right now our statewide snowpack, our snow water equivalent, I should say, is around 3,000% of normal, which sounds like a miracle, but the background, you know, median level of snowpack for this time of year is quite low. So The little bit of snow that we have on the ground is great, and we'll take it, and we're definitely encouraged by the forecast moving forward. But I don't want to get too excited about being that high above normal, because, again, the normals are so low. Precipitation, the same story. We're starting off above average right now. We're actually close to the 88th, 90th percentile, which is news that we just would have definitely embraced last year, and we'll take it this year. But we need to, again, contextualize that against the deficit that we've run for a couple years now in terms of precipitation. I've been telling people that we have, at this point, at the end of the last water year, we were running about a 13-inch deficit when it comes to precipitation, meaning that on top of the normal level of precipitation that we would need to get, we would need about 13 extra inches of moisture for the state to catch up to what would be considered more or less normal. And we've already boosted that this water year by a couple inches. So that number is down to about 11 inches now, just because of how well we're doing in October. And again, the forecast was looking pretty good. So that's great, and it's moving the needle in the right direction, but we still have a long way to go. Like I said, about 11 inches to go. And so we're really hoping that this trend continues. Last thing about this water year that's encouraging, and maybe the most encouraging thing, is our soil moisture conditions. We've really seen those soil moisture levels rebound in our mountains in Utah. Right now, we're at about 54% of saturation. Last year at this time, we were at about 24% of saturation.
Wow.
That's an extraordinary difference. Right now, we're significantly above average. When these records go back about 20 years, so we've got some good context. And that's really important, because if we can go into this year's snowpack season with even just average, certainly above average soil moisture, that means we're going to get a much more efficient return when that snow melts in the spring. We tend to lock in that level of soil moisture through the winter season once the snow starts to accumulate. So whatever we get in the late fall is basically, you know, that's what we're going to have in the spring when the snow starts to melt. And if we get reasonably moist soils, we're going to get a much more efficient delivery of that moisture from the snow into our reservoir system, which we did not get last year.
That's fascinating, because I remember when you were coming on here in the spring this year, I think you were talking about, as the snow is melting, that the ground moisture was not saturated, so we weren't getting as much runoff because it was absorbing in. Is that
right?
Correct?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And I at a recent presentation, I showed a graph looking at the headwaters of the Beaver River, where we have a snowtill site way up in that drainage called the Big Flat snowtill site. And you could see in the graph, you could see the water coming out of the snowpack, the snow water equivalent graph going down, down, down. And you watched the Beaver River just stay flat. There was almost no response in the Beaver River because all that moisture was being held up in the headwaters. Mm. It was just so dry through the previous winter that there really, it was just like a sponge sucking up most of the moisture, and that's why we wound up with abysmal stream flow content and forecast, and unfortunately our forecasts were even too optimistic, and that's why we wound up with 17 of our lowest flows ever recorded and 18 second lowest.
So what's happening right now out there is really great news. We know that we all woke up to full snow this morning here in Park City. So this is all good news as we move forward into next spring, you're saying?
Yeah, it's good news. You know, this snow is probably not going to stick around, but the moisture isn't going to just disappear. The
right.
moisture is going to stay in the soils, and that's really going to push our runoff in the right direction.
So basically, the soil takes its share first. You gotta fill the sponge before you get water running over the sponge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're at. So when you say soil moisture is at 54%, what does that percentage mean? Help us visualize what.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a good question. It's 54% of saturation. So if you imagine there being some void space in the soil column, if it's 100% of saturation, you've filled all those interstitial pores in the soil with water and with moisture. Right now, we're a little bit over half of those pores, if you will, being filled with moisture, which is a good value for this time of year. We don't certainly expect the soil to be saturated this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a good value. Like I say, it's 30% higher than the value from last year. So we're definitely on the right side of that normal curve.
Why is it so important to take all these numbers and to calculate them as we move forward and understand what's happening with our climate? Why is it so important that we do this?
How much time do you have?
We got 5 minutes.
You got some time.
5 minutes, okay.
Four minutes.
Certainly, I work for the Department of Agriculture, and there's a reason for that. Our main deliverable is to correlate the amount of water that the snowpack is storing on our mountains, and to do some predictions and forecast how much water we're going to have available in that April through July period based on those snowpack levels. So it's incredibly useful and critical for our water management community to know what's coming. Outside of the water user community, certainly we want to make sure that we understand from a recreation sense what's going on in the mountain and how well the snow is doing, what the snow densities are looking like, what the avalanche conditions are like. And that's not a minor thing. The recreational community is a huge economic sector in our state. And so they use our data as well. It's actually quite fascinating. There's so many different groups that use the data. So from a long-term perspective, the more that we can understand these trends, the more that we can anticipate and manage around what future conditions are going to be like. So at a recent meeting, my colleague Glenn Merrill with the River Forecast Center did a nice job presenting on some trends that he's seeing, where you see an increase over the last 20, 30 years, you see an increase in annual temperatures, but you don't really see any kind of a reliable trend in precipitation. And his point was, we don't really know what's going to happen with precipitation, but what we do know is that when we don't have precipitation, when we have these dry years, they're going to be both dry and hot, warmer than they used to be. And that is kind of a deadly combination, which is why we got into our drought so quickly this year. So the point is, again, what we're anticipating, what he laid out, I think, quite nicely, is when we have precipitation, it's a little hard to predict if it's going to be more or less than we had in the past. That the jury's kind of still out on that. But when we do get into these dry years, we're anticipating them being dry and hotter than they used to be, which exacerbates the drought situation.
Right, and I'm assuming that's a function of increased evaporation rates and increased in the summer, so an increased sublimation rates in the winter. Are you seeing trends there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's how we got into the soil moisture levels being so dry before last winter. That was exactly what happened, is we wound up in one of those very dry summers the year before, mm-hmm. that dried out our soils. They were also, it was quite a well above average temperature. And so the combination of above average temperatures inducing more evaporation, like you were just saying, really withdrew a lot more of the moisture from the soil column than otherwise would have happened.
All right, now we do have to wrap up. Where do people go to maybe get a copy of the September water report?
The easiest thing to do would be to just email me, Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N dot Clayton, C-L-A-Y-T-O-N, at USDA.gov. Or you can go to our webpage if you just Google Utah Snow Survey. Use your favorite search engine. I'm not in anybody's commission. Anyway, you'll find it, and it's a long URL, but if you just look it up in your favorite search browser.
And the October report will come out, the first 10 days of November or so?
That's correct. Yep, we typically get them out within the first week.
And I'm guessing the traffic on wanting to know more about that goes up about this time of year, as people are really wanting to understand what's happening with
that. With rain and now snow.
Absolutely, yeah, especially when we get these nice storm cycles, we get a little bit more traffic. And it's a little hard to tell what this winter is going to be like, but we certainly will have more reliable information as we get into, the early spring months and the late winter months.
Thank you so much.
Jordan Clayton, Data Collection Officer with the Utah Snow Survey, under the Department of Agriculture, like you say. Jordan, thanks for so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.